else inside. Festianos was bug-eyed.
Where did you get this?
He said. From your tent, One Eye exclaimed.
You searched our tent?
For a good reason, One Eye, I said. Bear with me.
This is medicine, said Festianos. For my arthritis and the shakes with which I am sometimes afflicted, a doctor prescribed it.
Is your doctor here at Olympia?
In Athens.
Then there's no way to corroborate your story.
Why should there be? It's medicine.
This is poison hemlock.
I don't deny it, said Festianos. The doctor warned me not to take too much at a time.
Or else?
Or else it could kill me. I am to swallow a vial when the pain in my joints is particularly bad or if my body begins to shake, and at no time am I to take more than one vial every 2 days.
Heraclides, who stood at the back of the room, nodded in approval. He said,
The statement of Festianos agrees with what many doctors would prescribe.
I said, Sirs, allow me to introduce Heraclides, a doctor from Kos. He told me that a potion made from a single leaf is medicinal, but that as few as 6 leaves are certain to be fatal.
Festianos shrugged.
I wouldn't know. I'm not a doctor.
How much hemlock is in each of these vials, Festianos?
I asked.
I believe 2 leaves.
You don't know?
All right, yes, it's 2.
Festianos wiped his brow. Heraclides?
I asked.
The doctor said,
2 leaves in a healthy man would not be a fatal dose.
But it would make a man sick, I asked.
He would feel lethargic, numb. He would be leaden-footed. Any movement would be a struggle.
Like an athlete having a bad day, I said.
The symptoms might resemble an athlete off his game.
Heraclides agreed.
Sirs, I turned to the judges. I have spoken with the pancratists who competed at Nemea. They say that when they fought against Timodemus, they felt as if they had heavy legs.
Nikolaos, what are you thinking?
Pericles said, beside himself. He wrung his hands.
Have you forgotten your orders?
Pericles trailed off. He dared not admit his orders to me before the assembled personages. I said, My Olympic oath requires me to prove or disprove Timo's guilt in the matter of the death of Arachos. I can only do so by discovering what really happened at Nemea last year. Pleistarchus said,
We all know what he's thinking, Pericles. And I must say the idea's an interesting one. Do you intend to protect this man?
You know I can't,
Pericles said testily.
Nikolaos suggests this man, Festianos, gave mild poison to everyone except his own nephew,
said King Pleistarchus, plainly intrigued. He had followed the conversation closely. I was sure he knew where this was going.
It appears we may have been a little hasty in condemning Timodemus.
Pleistarchus was obviously enjoying every moment of this.
What do you think, Exelon?
The chief judge looked at the king of Sparta with some irritation.
I think we need to hear the answer from Festianos.
This is ridiculous,
One Eye protested.
First my son is accused of murder, then my brother of poison. This is nothing less than a conspiracy against my family, and I demand—
You haven't proven a thing,
Festianos interrupted.
How did I get the poison into the athletes?
in their water bottles, I said promptly. The relative of a competitor is almost invisible, and no one watches the water bottles. Why should they? I faced the judges again and began to pace back and forth, a habit I'd picked up from Pericles. Sirs, at midday today, I told Festianos that Timodemus had been given permission to contest the games if he's found innocent.
Which is true, said Exelon.
Yes, sir. Festianos immediately poisoned the water of the other contestants. Festianos said,
You're making this up.
I smiled to myself. I thought you might say that. I stopped pacing. Pindar? Pindar stepped forward to stand beside me. The 10 judges stirred in their seats. The greatest living poet of the Hellenes was about to speak. Pindar cleared his throat.
Honored judges of these games, most sacred to mighty Zeus, he began in his beautiful voice. As Apollo, with well-strung lyre, sung before the gods of high Olympus, so I stand before you with these few simple words of...
I stamped on Pindar's toes.
Save the panegyrics for the paying crowd, I hissed. We have a man to redeem.
To cut a long poem short.
Pindar glared at me and rubbed his foot.
I affirm that I, Pindar the praise singer, watched this man Festianos leave his tent carrying the box you see. I observed him walk into the gym where were assembled the athletes for the pancration. I saw him walk back to his tent soon after.
Lies, said Festianos.
The word of Pindar is beyond doubt, said a minor judge.
Timodemus had watched his uncle's testimony with something like horror in his expression. Now he walked in front of Festianos, turned his back on the judges, and thrust his face so close to Festianos that I thought they might kiss or bite.
My win at Nemea wasn't a fair fight?
Timodemus whispered.
I didn't poison the bottles, nephew,
Festianos rasped.
It's all been a lie. I'm not the best at all.
Timo turned away and hid his face in his hands. Diotima reached into the evidence bag and withdrew a leather bottle. She placed it on the table. Festianos stared at it in surprise. I said, I took one of the contestant bottles after you left the gymnasium. Here it is. I paused for dramatic effect. Would you care to drink the water, Festianos? Festianos glared around at the assembly. He was a trifle wild-eyed. He reached for the leather bottle, opened the stopper, upended, and drank it down in rapid gulps.
There, you see?
He coughed a little.
River water mixed with wine. That's all it is. And not very good wine at that.
The faces about us showed disappointment, all except One Eye, who registered confusion, and Pericles, who looked relieved. Diotima reached into the evidence bag. Slowly, deliberately, she pulled out another bottle and placed it before Festianos.
Now try this one, she said. Nikolaos took more than one bottle.
Festianos stared at the bottle, at me, at the bag. The room was totally silent. Diotima reached into the bag for a third time. Without a word, she placed a third bottle before Festianos. I said to him, If you told the truth, your bladder will fill, and you'll be a little drunk. Nothing more. We waited. But Festianos only stared at his doom. The bottle you drank can't harm you, but three bottles is 6 leaves, enough to kill a man. Of course, if, as you say, there's only water and wine in there, then there's nothing that can hurt you, right? Festianos made no move.
Drink the water, Festianos, Exelon ordered.
Festianos reached forward. He took the next bottle and brought it to his lips. His hand shook. In one sudden motion, he upended it onto the floor. The liquid splashed out. Droplets fell on our feet. Then he leaned forward onto the table, head in his arms, and cried.
So it was Festianos who murdered Arikos,
murmured the chief judge. Oh, no, sir, I said. That's quite impossible. A man with arthritis like Festianos could never have raised his arms against Arikos. They all looked at me in shock. A judge shouted, Are you playing with us, young man? The answer was yes. I deserved some revenge after what these men had put me through, but what I said was, No, sir. It was necessary to demolish the motive that Sparta alleges against Timodemus.
How do you know Timodemus wasn't in it with Festianos?
Zanares said. You need only look at him, I said. Everyone did. Timodemus had buried himself in the corner of the room, his head against the whitewashed wood of the wall, oblivious to everything. I said, No, sirs. Timodemus had an extremely good reason to murder Arikos, but this wasn't it.
Had a good reason?
Pericles seemed close to apoplexy. Good. This would teach him to order me to fake an investigation. I said, Rivals in love, Pericles, but I'll let someone else explain that. Diotima opened the door. Clymene stepped in, shaking. Her skin was the color of dough. Clymene, daughter of Exelon, has important evidence for us, I told the assembled men. Clymene said,
Timodemus could not have killed Arikos.
She drew a deep breath.
Timodemus could not have killed Arikos because he was with me.
She paused.
In my tent,
she added, to make the point clear. Then, in case anyone in the room was terminally stupid, she finished.
We were having sex. Lots of it.
At least 5 judges dropped their cups of wine. One said in a horrified squeak,
But this means the entire games have been observed by a priestess in a state of pollution.
Yes.
The last 4 days are invalid?
If he hadn't been sunburned, the judge would have turned dead white.
If the people find out, we'll be slaughtered.
The judge beside Exelon turned to him and said,
I'm sorry, Exelon, my friend, but the penalty is prescribed. She must be thrown off Mount Typaeum.
Exelon said merely,
No,
in the faintest of voices. Clymene smiled bravely.
It's all right. I've had my fun. Timo and I can go together.
Why do you tell us this?
Another judge demanded.
Are you in love with this Timodemus?
If love is liking someone, in bed and out, then I suppose I am.
To get us all back to the important point, I said, Timodemus didn't do it. This leaves us with the problem of who did kill Arikos.
I suppose you know who that is,
Exelon said sarcastically. I call upon Petali the Pornay to give evidence. She will be assisted by... I'm very sorry about this. My brother.
Petali explained that she had seen Arakos leave the women's camp, and no one else. I said,
My brother Socrates will now explain how he used the coins in Petali's jar to calculate what time Arakos was seen walking into the woods.
Exelon stared in distaste at Petali and Socrates, a prostitute and a boy holding hands. He muttered,
I think we'll take your word for it, for the moment at least.
I breathed a sigh of relief. The idea of Socrates trying to explain anything to anyone was terrifying.
The evidence of Petali fixes the time of the murder, I said. Something the killer certainly didn't want. He needed to ensure there was some moment during the night when Arakos might have died, and Timodemus had no alibi. You'll notice the ostracon that demands the meeting is deliberately vague about the time. How is this possible? How could they have met? The only possible answer is the killer lured Arakos with a verbal message, one that gave a fixed time, and then planted the ostracon later.
I paused to let that sink in.
Which means the killer went to all this trouble to frame Timodemus.
It means nothing,
Xenares the Effer said.
All we have is the word of a whore, and...
He stared at Climene.
And the word of a girl who should be.
Pleistarchus said,
More to the point, it doesn't necessarily imply the killer had anything against Timodemus other than that the young man had made himself the perfect target for a false accusation.
I acknowledge the truth of what you say, Pleistarchus, I said gratefully. Let's move on to the death of Iphicles, the chariot driver.
An unfortunate accident, said Marcos.
Very unfortunate. Because Iphicles saw the murderer.
No, he saw Arakos.
Then why didn't Petali see Iphicles? I shot back. Petali says she saw Arakos and no one else leave the women's camp.
I paused for them to consider.
Iphicles, while blind drunk, followed a man through the women's camp and into the forest. It must have been either before or after Petali left her tent to relieve herself. The man directed Iphicles back onto the path to the river ford. That man must have been the murderer.
We'll never know now, said Marcos.
No, we won't. There's been an unfortunate tendency for witnesses to die. Let's consider the fake Heracles, who was murdered in the Temple of Zeus.
Marcos turned to the judges.
I remind you, sirs, the question in hand is the murder of Arakos. Any other deaths, however regrettable, are incidental.
Exelon nodded.
Marcos makes a fair point. This trial is for the murder of Arakos.
Thus was the death of the pathetic little Heracles consigned to the same insignificance as his life.
I tossed my two ostraca on the table to rest with the one Marcos had presented. The first message declares Timodemus innocent. The second asks for a meeting in the Temple of Zeus. Clearly the fake Heracles knew something about the murder.
The killer's name?
Suggested Pleistarchus.
No. The murder weapon, I said.
There are no weapons at Olympia,
said Exelon at once. Yes, there are, I replied. The clubs carried by the Heracles imitators.
perfect to beat a man to death, even a top pancratist, if he doesn't expect the blow, and especially if it comes from someone he has no reason to distrust. Arikos was stunned by the first blow to his forehead, just like the oxen in the sacrifice. After that, it was a simple matter to finish him. Silence, while everyone absorbed that. I could almost feel the ideas rearrange themselves in the minds of my audience. I said, "Someone took the club from the fake Heracles and used it to kill Arikos."
"You still have no proof," said Exelon.
"You're right, Chief Judge. It's not certain proof. But it was enough to make me look for certain proof." I held up the twisted bit of metal for everyone to see. "This is the linchpin from Iphicles's chariot." Then I turned to the murderer. "You made one mistake, Marcos. As soon as you knew Iphicles had seen you, the chariot driver had to die. You remembered the story of Pelops and King Animaeus, and how the groom Myrtilus pulled the linchpin. So you pulled the linchpin straight after the crew had checked the equipment. I even watched you crouch to do it. The entire pit crew can swear you were the only man who could have pulled this pin." Silence. Everyone waited for Marcos to speak. His expression gave nothing away. Without a word, Marcos pulled out a handful of coins. He placed them in a single pile on the table where everyone could count them. 50 drachmae. Marcos was no fool. He knew the door would be heavily guarded. So he ran for the window. Gorgo stood between him and his escape. Marcos raised his arm to strike her out of the way, and I gasped. Even a slight blow could kill the weak queen, but there was no time to reach him. Diotima threw her priestess knife. The blade slid across his arm and sliced the skin. Marcos yelped and skipped around Gorgo and dived through the open window.
"After him!"
a dozen voices shouted. I ambled over to watch. Marcos ran down the narrow lane. Standing at the end, blocking the path, was Pythax. Pythax snarled. Marcos had no club with which to beat a larger man now. He skidded to a halt, turned, and sprinted in the other direction. Straight into Dromaeus, who advanced from the other end. Dromaeus hammered him hard. Marcos staggered back. Pythax and Dromaeus converged on Marcos. They beat him with their fists. As far as they were concerned, Marcos was a dead man. Marcos, to his credit, took it in silence and hit back when he could. I'd always admired him.
"Gentlemen, if we could have him alive, please," I shouted.
"Here's what I think happened," I said, after a dazed, bruised, and bleeding Marcos had been hauled back between Pythax and Dromaeus. Even before the games began, Xenares gave Marcos orders to stir up trouble between Athens and Sparta, because the Ephors want a rallying cry to take down Athens.
"But Marcos is a member of the Hippas," Plistarchus objected. "Not the Crypteia."
"Actually, Plistarchus, he works for both. A double agent. When we interviewed Xenares about the Crypteia, Xenares assumed automatically that Marcos had told me there were Crypteia at Olympia. He hadn't. It was your mother, Queen Gorgo, who discovered it through her own sources. Marcos belongs to the Hippas, and the Crypteia are famously secretive. Why would Xenares assume Marcos could say where they are? On its own, it might not have meant much, but combined with the proof that Marcos had performed the killings, and that Gorgo confirmed there was no particular motive for any Spartan to murder Arikos, and that Marcos barely knew his victim, the only remaining reason was to cause trouble between Athens and Sparta, which it certainly did. The man at Olympia who hates Athens the most is Xenares, and the Cryptea take their orders from Xenares. Every eye turned to Xenares. He stood unrepentant.
I remind you, Pleistarchus, that a serving member of the Ephors cannot be indicted for any crime.
Your term has only 6 months left to run, said Pleistarchus coldly.
Then you are vulnerable.
That's as may be. Much can change in 6 months.
Pleistarchus and Xenares stared at each other, both men full of hatred. It was going to be a frosty trip back to Sparta. I said,
Arachos wasn't killed for rivalry in either sport or love. He was killed to start a war between Sparta and Athens. The philosopher Empedocles told me strife and love move everything. Arachos wasn't killed for love. He was killed for strife. It almost worked, too. How close are we to open fighting?
Close. Very close, Pericles said, and Pleistarchus nodded.
So, Marcos arrived at Olympia already with an eye out for opportunities to cause trouble. What's the first thing he sees? Timodemus attacks Arachos during the opening ceremony, in front of thousands of witnesses. It was a genuine case of rivalry between two great athletes and a squabble over a woman. Then and there, Marcos has his plan. He will murder Arachos in such a way that everyone believes only Timodemus could have done it.
My guess is, Marcos was inspired when he ran into the fake Heracles. Weapons are banned under the sacred truce, but no one considers those clubs a weapon. Marcos snatched the club from the fake Heracles, just as I did when he swung it at Diotima and me earlier that same afternoon. I imagine Marcos threatened the fake Heracles. He said the Cryptea would slit his throat if the Heracles said anything, and the fake Heracles, being from the Peloponnese, would be aware of the charming Spartan custom known as the Cryptea, of cutting the throats of irritating locals. Marcos lured Arachos into the woods with the false message, then beat him to death with the club. Astonishingly simple, really. But Olympia is a very crowded place. There was always the risk someone would see something. Iphicles, dead drunk, followed a man into the forest. As soon as Iphicles told us this before the race, Marcos crouched, ostensibly to inspect the chariot, but in fact to hide his face before Iphicles recognized him. While he crouched, Marcos had to think quickly. He pulled the linchpin, with the reasonable hope Iphicles would have a terrible accident on the track. And so it proved. That would have been the end of any hope of solving the crime, except the fake Heracles overcame his fear long enough to write me the two messages.
Why didn't the fellow approach you directly?
Pleistarchus asked. He tried, twice, I admitted ruefully. After he watched me take the Olympic oath, and once when I walked through the Agora, but both times he ran away. Now I know why. He ran both times because I was with the murderer. After that, he resorted to anonymous messages. It was sheer bad luck that Marcos was with me when I received the second message.
What about the eyes?
Asked Pericles. Marcos tore out the eyes of Arachos because it made the killing look more like the work of an angry pancratist. Putting the extra eyes on the body in the temple was his little joke. His sense of humor runs that way. I turned to him. I'm sad, Marcos. I thought we were friends. A couple of days ago, I thought to myself, I'd like to have you for a brother-in-law.
Marco smiled through his bleeding lips and broken teeth. The flesh about his eyes was already puffing up. He said,
"For my part, I thought you were an idiot. Congratulations. The way you hid your intelligence fooled me completely."
I decided not to tell him. It was mostly Diotima who had outthought him.
"I suppose you're not as inept as you appear,"
he went on.
"But I must say, keeping you alive was hard work. I had to save you twice. First at the Hippodrome, then with Scarathos."
"Why did you?"
I asked, genuinely puzzled.
"Because the whole point was to make Athens look guilty. With you alive, either you'd agree that Timodemus the Athenian was guilty, or you'd blatantly whitewash your man in a way no one believed. Either way, Athens would look terrible, and Sparta would have her rallying cry, as my orders demanded. But if you died, then Athens would have looked less guilty, and other cities might have had some sympathy for Sparta's enemy."
Gorgo was visibly shaken. She said,
"You, a Spartan, chose to murder a child of the 300?
Hung between Pythax and Dromaeus, Marcos turned his head to speak to her.
"It's not murder when you're acting under orders," he said. "It is not the case, Queen Gorgo, that sometimes an officer will sacrifice a man, perhaps many men, perhaps even himself, if it's the only means to win the war."
"Do not seek to lecture me on the nature of sacrifice, young man,"
Gorgo said. "Then you'll understand, Queen Gorgo, that the death of Arico served Sparta more than his life could ever have done. What would have happened if he'd lived? He would have come in second in the Pancration. You said it yourself, my queen. Coming in second means coming in last. But by his death, Arachos gave Sparta the chance to come in first in a much more important contest, the competition for Hellas. That's what my orders demanded, to begin that contest between Athens and Sparta."
Every eye turned to Zanares. The Ephor remained impassive under our united glare. Zanares, the Ephor, wasn't on trial here. He couldn't be, because he had killed no one. But I guessed from the expression of extreme anger on the face of Pleistarchus that the Ephors of Sparta would be in some difficulty the moment the Spartans were all back home. Marcos had spoken with no trace of remorse. There was no reason why he should. A good soldier doesn't feel guilty for what happens on the field of battle, and Marcos was the best of the best. The Spartan ritual of the Crypteia was a test of silent killing, and Marcos had excelled at it. That test had marked Marcos for a duty far removed from the common lot of a soldier in the ranks. Marcos had been given the most demanding duty any elite trooper can be asked to perform: targeted assassination for political ends. The difficulty was that Marcos seemed to enjoy his work, but then, what man doesn't take pride and pleasure from doing what he does best? Pericles cleared his throat for attention. The chatter ceased. He said in a pleasant voice,
"I think we can all agree Arachos was not killed by an Athenian."
Every eye turned to King Pleistarchus. Pleistarchus said,
"Sparta acknowledges
that the murderer was a Spartan. There's no need to continue this trial. This is now an internal matter for Sparta. We'll deal with it.
No need to continue?
Exclaimed Exelon, angry.
After all we've been through, after this man almost started a war on sacred Olympic soil, I don't think so.
Behind him, the other judges nodded.
The crime was committed at Olympia. It's an Olympic matter.
It's Spartan, said Pleistarchus. The victim is Spartan. The murderer is Spartan.
Olympic, I say,
Exelon repeated.
We can enforce this.
You and whose army? Pleistarchus said quietly. And there it was, out in the open, the threat of armed force against the religious authority of the sacred games. I noticed Pericles couldn't keep the self-satisfied smile from his face. I should have been pleased at his happiness, but I wasn't. I held my breath. Exelon said,
You wouldn't dare. All of Hellas would fight such sacrilege.
Wait! It was the voice of an old woman. Gorgo stepped forward slowly. Her steps hesitated for a moment, and Diotima took her arm to support the Dowager Queen of Sparta. Gorgo's hawk-like eyes took in the entire party as if we were prey. She said,
Before you men start slaughtering each other, let me make a point. If Sparta committed sacrilege, then you are right, Exelon. Even our closest allies would turn against us. But think of this. Have these games truly been sacred? Forgive me for mentioning it. I know the young woman is your daughter, but the priestess of these games is about as ritually clean as a sewer.
Ooh, that was a low blow. When it came to political pancration, Gorgo was Olympic strength. Climene laughed. Timodemus scowled and stepped toward Gorgo, but One Eye hauled him back. Exelon stood as if stunned. Gorgo said,
Is it not possible the gods cursed these games because of the state of the priestess? If they heard the story, the other cities might think so. Better, don't you think, for us to sort out these problems quietly?
Exelon looked ready to kill, but he whispered,
Perhaps, under the circumstances, this matter is best left to Sparta.
Gorgo smiled.
Very wise. Now, Exelon, I notice this beautiful new temple of Zeus puts the rest of Olympia to shame. The place needs brightening up. My son was about to mention that.
I was,
said Pleistarchus.
You were, my son, said Gorgo firmly. I'm sure Sparta would like to send a gift to Olympia, something substantial.
Oh, yes, I see. A good idea, Mother. Exelon. Sparta would be pleased to donate. I'm not quite sure what yet. If you have any ideas.
Perhaps some new statuary?
I put in quickly. Everyone looked at me in surprise.
I can recommend a good sculptor,
I explained.
You can?
Pleistarchus laughed.
I feel we all owe you, Nikolaos. Very well, then. Sparta would love to commission new statuary for the grounds in the spirit of our eternal friendship.
What do you say, Exelon?
That would be agreeable, Exelon grated. And now, before my happiness at this outcome can grow too great to bear, I must insist we depart for the Stadion. The next event is the Pancration, and it's long overdue.
The judges led us in, followed by Timodemus, then King Pleistarchus and Pericles, and the rest of us followed in a confused gaggle. Timodemus now wore that same bored expression that he always did before a fight. He was about to do what he was born for, compete at the Olympics. Climene took her box. The Stadion was packed to overflowing with men. The trial of Timodemus had taken longer than everyone but Diotima and I had expected, and now, from the loud buzz, I deduced there was a certain amount of irritation with the judges for their delay. The murmurs rose higher when men in the crowd noticed Timodemus among us. The other pancratists and their trainers stood in a group. Among them I saw Korolos, Agelion, and Megathenes. They were shocked to see Timodemus enter.
"You allow him to compete?"
Megathenes asked.
"We have determined two things,"
Exelon, the chief judge, said to the pancratists and the trainers.
"First, that Timodemus did not kill Arcos. Second, that this will be a fair contest."
Timo didn't break step. He walked over to his fellow pancratists. He spoke in his normal conversational voice so that they and those of us near him could hear.
"Men, I've only this day discovered that I won unfairly at Nemea. I never knew. May Zeus slay me where I stand if I lie."
Timodemus drew in a deep breath.
"I revoke my Nemean crown, which means the victor of Nemea becomes Arcos of Sparta."
The men murmured among themselves.
"And I promise you, I will compete today with the same disadvantage that you suffered at Nemea. That's only fair."
Timo turned around to face me.
"Nico!"
"Yes, Timo?"
"If I know your cleverness, you have more than three of the poisoned bottles in that bag, don't you?"
"Yes, I have them all." Diotima and I had swapped every poisoned bottle, fearing that Festianos might manage to slip some to the athletes.
"Good, because I'm thirsty."
I blinked.
"What? But Timo, you mustn't..."
"I said I'm thirsty, Nico. Give me something to drink."
I had never heard such command in his voice. I could see the strain he was under, the tension in his neck muscles. I hesitated. Timo repeated.
"Nico."
He held out his hand. Against my will, but unable to deny him, I handed over a bottle of hemlock. Timodemus held the poison to his lips and drank it down, swallowing over and over until he'd drained it to the last drop. Timo threw the bottle to the side and said,
"Now, let's fight."
A voice behind me said,
"I forbid it."
One Eye pushed past me to stand before his son.
"Timo, stop this now." "Isn't this what you want, father? Isn't this what I was born for? Didn't you train me every moment of my childhood for this one moment when you could see me at the Olympics?"
"Not like this," said One Eye. "I expected you to...
survive?"
Timo smiled a grim, grim smile.
"Did you know about Festianos?"
"No, son, I didn't."
But you suspected, didn't you?
One Eye looked away. Timo said,
"This time there'll be no cheating. This time, Zeus really does grant the victory."
One Eye hesitated for the longest moment, then he nodded and did something I am sure he had never done in his life. He took Timo in his arms and held him tight. They hugged for the longest time, while all the Hellenes watched them. Timo broke away and walked over to me.
"Thank you, Nico," he said.
"You don't have to do this, Timo," I said, quiet but urgent. He smiled sadly and said,
"You of all people know I can't abide a fight that isn't fair.
What happened at Nemea wasn't your fault."
"It wasn't a fair fight."
There were the same words he'd used when he'd saved me as a boy all those years ago.
"Listen, Nico, I want you to do something for me."
"Sure."
"Look after Climene, will you?"
Look after her how?"
"She might be in trouble with her father when all this is over. I don't want her hurt. And with Arikos dead and with me, well, the Pancration's dangerous. You know that."
"I thought she was just for fun. Good in bed, you said."
"Maybe I like her a little bit. You're my only friend. Swear you'll do your best to protect Climene. That's all I ask."
"I swear it."
I felt like I pronounced a death sentence. I stepped back to join Heraclides alongside the box where the trainers stood. It meant I was among the officials, where I could see and hear everything. But at this point, no one seemed to care. Timo walked over to the other pancratists. The lots were drawn for the bouts. The chief judge called,
"Begin."
There were four matches, to be held at the same time in four circles set out in a line along the stadium. At the call to begin, all eight pancratists advanced. Timo downed his opponent quickly with some swift kicks and a hard punch to the neck. The man went down unconscious, and Timo was declared the winner. He waited by the side while the other fights, more evenly matched, came to their completion. Two bodies were carried away, neither dead, both merely unconscious. I said,
"How is it, Heraclides, that Timo hasn't collapsed?"
"You forget that he's taken but a medicinal dose, the equivalent of 2 leaves. As the poison seeps through, it will slow his reactions, but not kill him. But I fear..." "Oh yes, he's doing it now."
Timodemus had picked up another of the bottles and downed it for the next bout.
4 leaves is survivable," Heraclides said. "Unless the person is old or weak, and your friend is certainly neither of those."
Timodemus was noticeably slower in the next fight. He faced Megathenes. Megathenes hit out and landed some hard blows, though everyone could see Timodemus try to react. Dromaeus leaned over the box where he stood with the other trainers and said to us,
"You see what's happening? Timodemus sees the blows coming, but he's not fast enough to dodge."
Heraclides said,
"It's the drug."
He shook his head. The skill of Timodemus showed despite his slowed reflexes. He allowed Megathenes to come at him, grabbed him about the waist, and rolled backward. Megathenes rolled over him. Timodemus finished on top. He struck Megathenes in the head 1, 2, 3, 4 times. When Timodemus climbed unsteadily to his feet, Megathenes remained down and unconscious. Exelon called the final round. Timodemus picked up the final bottle.
"No!"
Climene stood in her box.
"No!
She shouted again, and the whole stadium of men looked at her in stunned surprise. The priestess of the games had spoken. She stepped out of her box and went to the judges, who were clustered next to where I and Heraclides and the trainers stood.
"I refuse to see these games," Clymene declared.
"What?"
The chief judge could not have appeared more surprised if his daughter had declared herself to be a Gorgon.
"You can't mean that."
"I do. Don't you see Timodemus plans to kill himself with the poison?"
Clymene demanded.
"As long as the games proceed, that's the important thing. Daughter, he might well have died in the contest in any case."
"But he was to be your son-in-law."
"We may be revising that plan."
"Timodemus is a good man. He's a better person than I am."
Clymene looked abashed. Timo had walked over when Clymene abandoned her box. He seemed preternaturally calm. Now he said,
"That's not true, Clymene. You're a better person than you know. You saved my honor in the court."
"Timo, don't do this,"
Clymene begged.
"Our lives are brief enough as it is. Don't go making them any shorter."
Timo winced. He said,
"This is a matter of honor, Clymene."
"What honor? Your uncle cheated, Timo. You want to make up for his crimes? Then go ahead and lose these stupid games. But your uncle didn't kill anyone. You don't have to die for what he did."
"Don't you understand, Clymene?"
Timo said, perplexed at her words.
"It wasn't a fair fight."
Clymene threw her arms up in despair.
"You men are idiots! If you're bent on suicide, I'll not help you."
Clymene stalked off without another word, leaving her father to stand there alone, while the assembled Hellenes watched a man unable to control his own daughter. Clymene couldn't be stopped. The chief judge didn't dare beat the priestess of the games. To do so would have brought down the worst luck imaginable. Exelon slowly turned to face the crowd, his face gray. He drew in a great breath and shouted, in a voice that carried across the stadium,
"Hellenes! We have no priestess to observe the sacred games. Therefore I must declare..."
"Yes, you do!"
Diotima called out. She stood at the stadium's entrance. Everyone turned to stare at her. The chief judge said,
"Women are not permitted."
"I'm a priestess,"
she said loudly, so that the whole stadium could hear her words. Diotima waited at the entrance for an invitation to enter. Every man present watched in silence as the chief judge walked the 100 paces across the field to speak to her in private. I hurried across too, anxious to find out what Diotima thought she was doing.
"Are you a priestess of Demeter?"
the chief judge asked her quietly.
"Artemis,"
she said.
"Do you have time to be choosy?"
"The priestess of the games must serve Demeter. When the crowd finds out, they'll..."
"I won't tell them if you don't. Why don't we pretend you never asked me that question?"
Exelon looked at her for a moment, then at the crowd, and I could see the rapid calculation racing through his mind. If he stopped the games now, there would be a riot. Already we could see a few ripples in the crowd where scuffles had broken out. Exelon said,
"Take the stand."
He walked to the stadium center to tell the crowd that the goddess Demeter, in her wisdom, had seen fit to send a replacement. To the background of loud cheers, I said,
Teotima, you know what you're doing, don't you? Teemo wants to poison himself.
How would you feel if your life's greatest moment turned out to be a lie?
She asked.
Teemo needs this extirpation.
Even if it kills him?
That's his choice,
said my priestess of the hunt.
What do you think Timo's life will be like if he lives? What will men say of him? Besides, I seem to recall two men who battered each other almost to death in public, and you refused to stop it.
I could only hang my head. Diotima stepped past to take her place in the box Climane had vacated. She spurned the chair and stood. Her hands gripped the railing like a judge about to pass sentence. She was every bit the haughty priestess. I went back to the cluster of people from the trial. Timodemus drank down the final bottle.
6 leaves,
Heraclides said to me.
A fatal dose.
The chief judge of the sacred games looked to Diotima for permission. Diotima nodded.
Begin,
Exelon called. The referees took their positions, and Timodemus began the contest that would kill him. Heraclides scratched a note into an ostracon.
Socrates, I want you to take this note to my wife. Tell her I want these medicines and instruments laid out before I arrive.
Socrates took the note and ran. Will Teemo make it to the end, do you think? I asked. Heraclides said,
I don't know which is stronger, the poison or his remarkable reserves of willpower.
Korolos punched Teemo, hitting him in the same spot in the diaphragm over and over, obviously hoping to deprive him of any chance to breathe. Timodemus doubled over and spewed.
Good, said Heraclides. We can hope that's taken out some of the poison with it.
You mean he might live? I said.
Who knows? His extreme exertion spread the poison much more quickly, and he's a small man. But he's also in outstanding condition, and there's no telling how much of the poison that vomit might have brought up.
Korolos landed a massive kick against Timo's leg. Everyone saw it coming. But Teemo couldn't move. The whole stadium heard Timo's legs snap. They could see the bone poking through his skin. Every man gasped and waited for the inevitable moment when Teemo raised his arm in defeat. But Teemo didn't. He kept on fighting.
Dear gods! He's fighting with his bones sticking out!
I heard someone exclaim. I looked beside me for the voice and saw it was Pericles. He looked distinctly ill at the ugly sight. In the crowd behind me, someone retched.
He doesn't feel a thing,
Heraclides said in astonishment, and then,
Oh, but of course! The poison's deadened all feeling in his legs. While he's in this state, there's nothing Korolos can do to hurt him.
Timodemus stood there on his broken leg and ignored the blows raining down upon him. He grabbed the throat of Korolos and squeezed. There was no art in what Timodemus did, but he had no time for art. Korolos fell to his knees. Teemo didn't relent for an instant. He grinned the rictus smile of supreme effort. Any moment now, Korolos would expire for lack of air. His face turned blue. It was surrender or die. Korolos raised his arm in defeat. Timodemus let go, staggered sideways, forward, backward, forward. He dribbled uncontrollably, then doubled over and vomited again. He gasped for breath. His eyes rolled up, and he collapsed. The crowd gasped. Men wept and beat each other.
Timodemus of Athens is the victor,
the chief judge called. He stood over the inert form as if this had been nothing but a normal bout.
Heraclides said to me. There might still be time. As soon as the ceremony is over, bring him to the Iatrian as quick as you can. I'll wait there for you.